Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting today from a community experiencing a happy homecoming for Kenneth Bay and Matthew Todd Miller, who just last week were presumed lost in the impenetrable mysteries of North Korean politics as hostages. We are at the studios of KUOW in Seattle, whose reporters fanned out all over town over the weekend, including at the Quest Church in the Interbay neighborhood of Seattle, where there was a joyous prayers-answered service for Bay. There was also this news conference at the joint Lewis McChord military base just outside of Seattle, where now former hostage Ken Bay spoke to reporters.
Thank you all for supporting me and standing by me during this time. And it's been just amazing blessing to see so many people being involved, getting me released for the last 2 years.
We're finally here. My brother is home. We are so thankful.
That's Ken Bay's very happy sister, Terry Chung, who couldn't resist adding this detail about her brother's health after years in captivity.
So we got home last night, and none of us had eaten dinner. So we were trying to figure out, like, oh, where should we go eat? And, you know, we thought about all of our favorite Korean restaurants. And he said, well, I don't want Korean food. That's all I've been eating for the last 2 years. And he's like, I want a burger or pizza or something, you know. So we saw that Papa John's was open around the corner. So that's the that was the first meal he had.
Papa John's for peace. There's another surprise. We will have more about the hostage release this hour. Dryness in Arkansas and floods of prisoners in California addressed by last week's ballot measures. And a look back at the slow fight for justice pursued by the families of three American nuns in El Salvador more than 30 years ago. But first, American Kenneth Bay and a second hostage, Matthew Todd Miller, released to the custody of James Clapper, U.S. Director of National Intelligence, on a personal trip to North Korea. Matthew Todd Miller was arrested in North Korea for committing hostile acts under the guise of a tourist and was sentenced to 6 years in prison. Kenneth Bay had been held in North Korea since November of 2012 and was sentenced to 15 years of hard labor. He was in North Korea as a tour guide and Christian missionary. Derek Skiba is a friend of the Bay family who told reporters that Ken Bay's goodwill has contributed to peace.
What's really incredible to me through all of this is hearing him say that his heart still aches for people in North Korea, and to know that there are countless thousands of others that we don't even know who are still locked up. Kenneth wouldn't have been in North Korea if he didn't love the people of North Korea. His dream was to essentially lower the walls that we have between us and realize that we are all human beings and that regardless of the country, we can love each other and understand each other better.
Is that really possible now, and what does this all mean for U.S.-North Korean relations? An assessment now from David Sanger, chief Washington correspondent for The New York Times. David, welcome back to The Takeaway.
Good to be with you, John.
So how unusual is it for the Director of National Intelligence, James Clapper, to be engaged personally in a mission like this?
Well, unusual for a couple of reasons. First, he's not a diplomat. He has not usually dealt with the North Koreans. But secondly, I can't remember the last time, I'm sure one of our listeners will recall one, where we have sent the most senior American spy into sort of the heart of darkness to an adversary state for such a mission. Certainly we've had CIA directors and even some DNIs go to places like Russia and China, which are big intelligence targets, but which we also work with cooperatively, but not a place like North Korea. And I think what you have to remember here is he was sent precisely for the mission of not negotiating. That the Obama administration did not want to make it appear as if they were doing some kind of a trade, like the resumption of the six-party talks over the nuclear program or some lifting of sanctions in return for the freedom for Mr. Bai and Mr. Miller.
Is the apparent equality of Mr. Bay and Mr. Miller an admission by the North Koreans that they're just taking hostages here, that there's no distinction between missionaries and folks just caught, you know, behind on the other side of the border?
Well, the last time I had a lengthy conversation with a North Korean diplomat, it was the North Korean ambassador to the United Nations, he was describing what he called the terrible crimes that these men had committed. Mr. Bay was a missionary, and the North Koreans interpreted his activity as intended to ultimately, or so they said, to ultimately stage a coup against the government. I'm not quite sure how one American missionary in North Korea could quite do that, since the government has survived through three generations and a lot of attempted coups brought about by North Koreans who opposed the leadership family. But in any case, that was the charge. In the case of Mr. Miller, that was a more complex case. He came in, tore up his visa, if you believe the story that's around, perhaps asked for asylum. The North Koreans thought that he was trying to get sentenced to a prison camp that when he got out, if he got out, he could write about and embarrass them.
So the Seattle area is certainly, you know, thrilled with the release of Kenneth Bay, and his family here, and his greetings here have all been joyous. I'm wondering if the Obama administration is on the verge of some sort of, you know, breakthrough regarding North Korea that's similarly joyous, and might we include Iran in that? Both of these are, you know, dark nuclear confrontations that the spies of the U.S. are heavily involved in.
We might or might not be on the verge of a breakthrough with Iran. You know, the president's letter to the supreme leader in mid-October pointed toward a larger relationship if you could get a nuclear agreement in the next 2 weeks. With North Korea, I think it's a very different thing. The only letter that Mr. Clapper went with was one in which the president said, "This man is my representative. Deal with him and release the hostages," basically, is was sort of the tone. It was not quite that blunt. So I don't see any motion in the U.S. government toward any kind of resumption of a relationship with the North Koreans. I think they think at this point the best thing to do is sort of freeze them out. With Iran, it's a completely different issue. And of course, Iran does not yet, to our knowledge, have a nuclear weapon. And if it did get one, it could lead to proliferation throughout the region. North Korea has tested several, three, actually, and unlikely that it would trigger proliferation or more internal dynamics within within Asia than it already has.
What's the issue for Mr. Clapper here? It's hard to figure out what's going on in Washington right now with the sort of changing of the guard, but is this a bit of a redemption for him since he's so well known as somebody who lied about U.S. Intelligence policy in the wake of the Snowden revelations, et cetera?
Well, John, he would dispute the notion that he lied.
Of course.
But certainly he has said that he thought his statement, which he said was intended to protect a classified program, was misleading. His reputation, though, was quite sullied by that. And he's not somebody who sort of sits around wooing the press or anything like that. He's a very reclusive figure, a former general. He really is something of a throwback to a Cold War kind of character who we don't usually see in Washington these days. Kind of refreshing for that in an odd way. But I think that he certainly will, this will begin to change his reputation a bit. But let's remember, while it's wonderful that Mr. Bai and Mr. Miller are both out, these were not, you know, high-level, you know, spy swaps or something. These were two Americans who got caught up in the North Korean gulag machine.
And Bay and Miller's release does not necessarily represent an initiative directly from Kim Jong-un, since these talks themselves were at a relatively – talks, who came and called them that – these discussions were at a relatively low level.
I can't imagine they would have released them without Kim Jong-un signing off on it. I just don't think you do anything of significance with the United States without Kim Jong-un signing off on it. But interestingly, he didn't see Mr. Clapper because he views himself as Kim Jong-un views himself as the president of a country who therefore should only deal with the president of a country.
Or Dennis Rodman.
Or Dennis Rodman. Well, there is the Rodman exception. It is interesting that they chose General Clapper and not Dennis Rodman, don't you think?
Yes, I love that. We could talk hours about that.
Now, there's a diplomatic choice.
David Sanger, thanks so much.
Take care, John.
David Sanger, Chief Washington Correspondent for our partner, The New York Times. This is The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. The ideas of wet and dry, that is, alcohol-free counties, are left over from the days of Prohibition in the state of Arkansas. But they are a part of the frothing business plan of brewmaster Lacey Bray. She's the owner and business manager of Ozark Brewing Company in Rogers, Arkansas. Lacey's craft brewery opened in 2013 just after Benton County went wet. Well, voters last week rejected a ballot measure in the state to make the whole state of Arkansas wet, so the county-by-county rules stand, which is just fine to Lacey Bray.
Actually, if you're in a wet county, it's a pretty great time to be a brewery in Arkansas right now.
So a wet county means the sale of alcohol is permitted.
Yes.
And that would, I gather, increase your demand from the dry counties who take a little drive over to where you are.
Yeah, absolutely. And then just in general, the beer culture in Arkansas is just a little bit behind other places in the U.S. And so absolutely, people are excited to have craft beer here. And so seek it out for sure.
So what's the problem at the ballot box?
It's really interesting. So Arkansas has 38 wet counties, 37 dry, so about 50-50. Right now, to get a measure on the ballot about the purchase of alcohol, you have to have 38% of all of a county's registered voters sign a petition to even get it on the ballot. That's in comparison to any other referendum, you only need 15% of the registered voters. And so this amendment that had come up in the last voting period for us was allowing the whole state to vote and decide whether or not the whole state would go wet. And they were saying that, you know, really this would allow, you know, more people to have a voice and to at least let people vote on it instead of having to get the 38% beforehand before people can even talk about it.
What is it about Arkansas? I mean, is there a particular memory of a particularly horrible time in Arkansas where, you know, people were, you know, sawing their arms off at the lumber yard kind of thing because they were so wasted?
You know, I don't think so. I think it's just there are folks that definitely have some very deeply held beliefs on alcohol, I think rooted in, you know, religion. And that's part of it. But what you see right now also is that a lot of the opposition that is coming, that came to this amendment, and a lot of the money that came to oppose it actually came from liquor stores in the state. It came from what we call county line liquor stores. So liquor stores that are literally on the boundary of a wet and a dry county, where people have to actually drive to purchase alcohol. And so a lot of these liquor stores put up a lot of money to get this to fail, because they know that they have a lot to lose if people didn't have to drive so far to get alcohol.
So there's a prohibition constituency, just like there was back in the 1930s.
Yeah.
No kidding. Canadians were very sad when we voted out prohibition. That's for sure.
Yeah. Exactly.
The same kind of thing. You're not descended from the WCTU or anything like that, are you?
Nope, not that I know of anyways.
So tell me about your beer.
We have a small brewery here in Rogers, Arkansas. Our kind of motto is hard work, honest beer, and we take it from the region. The Ozarks that we are in are very typically very proud people and very proud of their craft and of what they do and their independence. And so we're just trying to live by that and make beer that for our local community.
Lacey Bray, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Better luck next time around if this comes up as a statewide measure. We'll just have to see and check with you then.
Absolutely.
Lacey Bray is the owner and business manager of Ozark Brewing Company in Rogers, Arkansas. California California can't do much about its drought, but it took a big step toward reducing the flood of prisoners in its jails with a ballot measure last week that would reduce penalties for non-serious and non-violent property and drug crimes from felonies to misdemeanors. At least 10,000 prisoners will be eligible for review. It could create a backlog in the California court system. As of Friday, an estimated 35 people had already been released, and public defenders' offices in the state are gearing up to review eligible cases. To talk about this is Jonathan Simon, Adrian Cragen Professor of Law at UC Berkeley and Director at the Center for the Study of Law and Society at UC Berkeley. Professor Simon, welcome to The Takeaway.
Thanks for having me.
So how does this law work, and is this a good way of dealing with prisoner overcrowding, given that it will certainly create a court backlog?
Yes, well, the courts and our public defender's offices are going to have to scramble, and the state may need to make more funds available down the line. But I think ultimately this will save the state a lot of money as it moves some prisoners out who are among our older prisoners, prisoners that have served a lot of time, many of whom are chronically ill and will both benefit from better health in the community and save the state a lot of money. So I think this was an important step.
In American legal terms, this is the electorate basically saying we've had enough with three strikes laws, and that's something that's likely to translate nationally.
That really is epic, because you may recall that it's almost precisely 20 years ago when California voters, in a similar great wave of the electorate, passed the three strikes law, much more severe type of three strikes law than anywhere else in the country. And it really did sort of set the tone for the very aggressive expansion of sentencing and prison populations in the 90s. So now to have the voters come back and say, we don't believe in this anymore. We've seen some of the results of mass incarceration in terms of the overcrowding and the illness in prisons, and we don't really believe this is keeping us safe. That's a very important message for especially elected leaders to hear.
And it suggests, Professor Simon, that the electorate has basically suggested that they were manipulated by these tough-on-crime candidates who they elected in the 80s and 90s and who were supposed to make people safer. And clearly now it's the electorate that's had to deal with the consequences of that law. That's a really important lesson at all levels of government.
I think so. And there's two dimensions here. One is that many people were not aware really of what the law did at the time they voted for it. I mean, the phrase three strikes and you're out implies that you're going to make equally bad crimes. And after enough of them, you're going to be put in prison. So what is really the sneaky aspect of three strikes, that the second strike or the third strike doesn't have to be a violent or serious crime. It can be any felony to get you the extended sentence. That's a part that really voters probably did feel manipulated about as they learned about it. But the other dimension is that, you know, 1994, violent crime was much higher than it is today. It was beginning to go down, but for many Americans and Californians, we were in the midst of basically a 25-year period of very high crime.
When the first released prisoner murders someone or gets involved in some violent criminal case, does the whole thing get reversed because a candidate will take it up as a cause célèbre?
That's certainly what politicians here have been worrying about. I mean, we've had realignment over the last 2 years. About 30,000 prisoners who would have gone to prison ended up in county jails or on probation in order for the state to comply with the Brown versus Plata prison population reduction order. Criminologists have been looking carefully to see if that's affecting crime rates, and it doesn't appear to be affecting violent crime at all. There's a bit of an uptick in some property crimes, but given the cost of thousands of prisoners, a very good trade-off. It creates a real cautiousness, and that's one of the reasons this vote was so important. Correctional realignment was designed to make sure that no existing prisoner would get out early, precisely so that politicians could say we didn't let anyone out. Here, the voters have actually said we want people out early, earlier than they would normally spend if they served their whole sentence.
And it's certainly great that the great state of California becomes the laboratory for this law, because there's such a huge momentum in the state, a large population, and the national implications of this are likely to proceed much more rapidly. Jonathan Simon is Adrian A. Cragen Professor of Law at UC Berkeley, Director of the Center for the Study of Law and Society, and author of the book Mass Incarceration on Trial, A Remarkable Court Decision and the Future of Prisons in America. Professor Simon, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Our Our friends at Retro Report this week remind us of a brutal milestone in the U.S. intervention in Central America 34 years ago with the killing of four American women, three nuns, and one lay missionary in El Salvador, who were part of no war and who were there only to serve the poor.
In my work, it has been very much trying to help people to realize their own dignity, to realize the great beauty that they have.
That was Moira Clark, one of the nuns who was killed. The bodies of her and three others, Sister Ida Ford, Sister Dorothy Kazel, and Jean Donovan, were found in a shallow grave by a road, victims of the U.S.-supported Salvadoran military regime. The U.S. ambassador to El Salvador, Robert White, was there when the bodies were unearthed on December 4th, 1980.
I found the town clerk. He told me that they had heard the screams and the shots the night before, and that it was the military who had done it. And you realize at that point that the Salvadoran military were out of control. I mean, they would kill anybody.
Then U.S. Ambassador to El Salvador Robert White with some very bitter memories there. It was all part of the Cold War. It was a U.S. foreign policy cover-up, and it and the whole Salvadoran episode put reporters in the line of legal fire from the Reagan administration. Here to tell us more about all of this is Ray Bonner, contributing reporter for Retro Report and a former foreign correspondent for the New York Times. Ray, welcome to The Takeaway.
Hi, John.
How important was this story, and how shocking was it at the time?
It's hard to over-dramatize how important it was and how shocking it was. I mean, there had been 10,000 murders in El Salvador that year, mostly students and peasants killed by the military. The Archbishop of El Salvador had been killed in March, murdered while he was saying a mass. But nothing caused a reaction like the killing of these American churchwomen.
And yet it bound the Reagan administration more to the Salvadoran regime, it seems, at least in the early going. Here's Alexander Haig, Secretary of State under Ronald Reagan, giving what sounds like a very clumsy sort of rationale for what might have happened.
Perhaps the vehicle that the nuns were riding in may have tried to run a roadblock or may have accidentally been perceived to have been doing so, and there had been an exchange of fire.
How was that received at the time, Ray Bonner?
Even today, I find it startling. I mean, it was just total disbelief to suggest that they ran a roadblock. I mean, it was so clear what had happened. Ambassador White had been at the scene. He knew what had happened. He had talked to people. It was clear they'd been killed by the military. But it was Central America was the center of U.S. foreign policy at the time. It may be hard to understand that 30-some years later, but Central America was to foreign policy then what the Middle East is now. It was where Ronald Reagan said, we are going to draw the line. This was the line in the sand. And they could not continue providing military aid to the Salvadoran government if the military had been involved in the killing of the nuns. And that's why you had these statements by Haig and by Jean Kirkpatrick.
And President Ronald Reagan emphasized to the American people that this was the Cold War. This was regardless of the human rights situation in Central America. This was his standoff with the Soviet Union. Here's Ronald Reagan.
El Salvador is nearer to Texas than Texas is to Massachusetts. Central America is simply too close and the strategic stakes are too high for us to ignore the danger of government seizing power there with ideological and military ties to the Soviet Union.
What lessons do you hear from those words back then and what's going on in U.S. foreign policy today?
It's just hard to believe that they felt that strongly at the time. I mean, there was this concern about the falling dominoes. Nicaragua had fallen to a leftist revolutionary government, and there was concern that El Salvador would. But as the ambassador, Robert White, used to mock it, he'd say, yes, they're worried about Nicaragua, El Salvador, Guatemala, all the way up to the soft underbelly of Kansas.
Ray Bonner, how did this story in El Salvador widen and become the Contras in Nicaragua, the various interactions between U.S. foreign policy and these regimes that really it may have brought helped to bring down the Soviet Union, but it presaged all kinds of other difficulties with the U.S. entanglements with governments around the world?
Well, I don't know that it led to bringing down the Soviet Union. It's just, at the time, this was considered the front line in the war against Soviet expansion, against Soviet communism, and particularly Cuba. But as Ambassador White said, This was a homegrown revolution. Ambassador White sent a 27-page cable soon after he arrived in El Salvador, and it's an extraordinary document laying the situation, laying out the situation and describing what was going on. And he says, this is a homegrown revolution. Cuba's role is marginal. There would be a revolution here even if there weren't Cuba, because it was the poor and the dispossessed, students and political moderates, who were trying to take on the military and the oligarchy. And the U.S. put it in the Cold War context, that it was part of the war against communism. You'll remember, John, when, and I can't remember this exactly, what it was, either Baker or Shultz became Secretary of State. They said, basically, what are we doing in Central America? And they began to pull back.
Although the American people were told that all these confrontations led to the end of the Cold War, and if you look at Afghanistan as a case in point, nothing about the local situation in Afghanistan was pertinent to the Reagan administration. It was simply fight this war against the Soviet Union, and whether we're talking about Central America or Afghanistan, we'll just deal with the consequences later. And even today, we are dealing with the consequences from Central America.
We certainly are today dealing with the consequences in Central America. I mean, whatever link seems to me, and you covered Afghanistan and I didn't, but whatever link you can draw between Afghanistan and the collapse of the Soviet Union, because the Soviet Union did get bogged down there, I do not think that applies in Central America. You've got these tiny countries. I remember a friend asking me once, John, this was back in 81 or 82. She said, and she was perplexed by the American foreign policy. She said, how big is Nicaragua? And I said, like 3 million people. It was hard to believe, and it's even harder to believe from this distance, that we thought the security of the United States was threatened by what was happening in El Salvador.
Remembering 34 years ago, the killing of 4 American women, 3 nuns, and 1 lay missionary in El Salvador. Ray Bonner, contributing reporter to Retro Report and former New York Times foreign correspondent in El Salvador, who covered the story. Ray, thanks so much for speaking to us.
Good to talk to you, John.
Conclude this hour by noting how policy changes made, many of them secretly in the wake of the 9/11 attacks, retain a capacity to shock even 13 years after the formal war on terror began. We continue now with reporter James Risen, who awaits his fate in a case where he is being compelled by the Justice Department to testify against his sources, something he refuses to do. If anything, his latest book is an unabated continuation of his mission to lift the secrecy veil hiding the implications of the war on terror. Pay any price, greed, power, and endless war. Risen says the Obama administration has made permanent a war footing that the American public will be paying for generations.
What we now have, I think, in the war on terror is a homeland security industrial complex, which is different from the military industrial complex. It's more about pouring hundreds of billions of dollars into intelligence contractors and counterterrorism contractors, companies that do secret work for various secret agencies. And so it's much more difficult for the American people to see what's happening. In the Cold War, there were congressional debates that were open and public about defense budgets and missiles and things like that. We don't have an open public debate at all today. And one of the things that's happened is over 13 years, we've had this very open-ended involvement in a war on terror, which is kind of like the war on drugs. I mean, terror is an abstraction. It's easy to define victory or defeat or continued operations in however you want to do it. And because there's very little oversight, we have this new national security apparatus that's grown since 9/11 far beyond anyone realizes it.
And, you know, part of that, you know, lack of debate means that, you know, it's almost unspeakable to bring up this subject. How would you say the communist threat, the Warsaw Pact threat, the tanks that were lined up in Europe, stacks up against guys with hoods and knives and the other, you know, maniacs who constitute this very well-televised threat called ISIS and the terrorists of the world?
You know, the problem is that we have allowed ourselves to become the captives of our own fears. And, you know, granted, some of these terrorists are dangerous people. but they don't represent an existential threat to the United States. They don't represent an imminent threat to the United States. And we have allowed ourselves to engage in 13 years of fear-mongering and hyperbole and panic, frankly, that has given the government and these secret agencies carte blanche to do whatever they want to do, to grow dramatically with no debate. And that's really the tragedy to me. That every politician who wants to raise any skepticism about the war on terror is immediately called soft on terror. Mm-hmm. And they're
or unpatriotic.
Down. Right.
Unpatriotic. You have a lot of anger, it seems, for President Obama in this book. I mean, there was a lot of anger for George W. Bush because he went after you, you know, with a chainsaw of, mm-hmm. of lawyers. And mm-hmm. But I think the way in which you claim that Obama has enshrined and made permanent mm-hmm. this national security establishment, I think inspires in the tone of this mm-hmm. even more anger.
I think it's more outrage than anger.
Yeah.
I mean,
yeah.
I feel like when you investigate the government, and that your job is to investigate constantly, which is what my job has been for my whole career, you see the flaws in people pretty fast. And I think the problem for Obama is that he decided early on in his presidency that he was going to focus – this is my opinion. This is why I think this happened. I think he decided he was going to focus on domestic policy, economic policy, healthcare policy, and that he didn't want to fight with the Republicans on national security policy. And I think he decided that continuing and extending and making permanent the national security state, the counterterrorism programs that Bush had put in place, protected one of his flanks politically. And I think that was his initial thought. And then as he got into office and brought in many of the same people that Bush had had on national security, I think he began to realize that executive power is a great thing to have once you're the executive. So I think he has succumbed to the seductions of power.
You know, a lot of what's written about in here is stuff that we're familiar with on a certain level, but it's sort of just nailed home. Paul Wolfowitz, you know, forgive me for talking about, you know, your prologue.
That's great.
Lots of people do that. But why do you think Wolfowitz has no apparent remorse, a sense of, boy, did I mess up here?
That is one of the great questions because
yeah.
One of the reasons I wrote that prologue is the way I did was I was trying to sit down with him and talk. And we talked a couple times. I had heard rumors. He did have second thoughts and doubts. Those were unconfirmed rumors, and I never was able to have any conversation with him in which he professed any second thoughts. But that led me to the prologue, which I love. I mean, I'm glad you brought that up because I went to see him and to see this Iraq Liberation Day celebration in, at Arlington National Cemetery, which I found to be an incredibly poignant thing to be there. It was Section 60, if you've ever been to Section 60 in Arlington, is where the dead of the Iraq War lay buried. And they are the freshest graves at Arlington. And it's very heartbreaking to go there because you see ribbons and photos of small children and wives all along the graves because they're so fresh. And they had on April 9th, 2009, the small band of pro-war supporters had a ceremony there for the sixth anniversary of the fall of Baghdad. April 9th, 2003 was the day the statue of Saddam fell in Fardo Square.
Yeah, yeah.
And 6 years later, after a very grim war, only about 50 people were there to celebrate. And they were the only people who still called that Iraq Liberation Day. And Paul Wolfowitz was there.
And meanwhile, in Baghdad, there were 30,000 people
protesting against the United States' continued involvement in the war.
It's just...
And so I was there really to see Wolfowitz, but then I realized that the ceremony was very interesting because Viola Drath, this aging socialite, was there as the master of ceremonies. And she had arranged for all these Iraqi diplomats and other people to be there and give little speeches. And then 2 years later, she was found murdered in her home by her husband, who dressed up as an Iraqi army general. and who claimed that Nouri al-Maliki had made him a general. And I thought, this is like a little perfect metaphor for what the war on terror really is all about, which is you never know what's real and what's concoction in this war.
James Risen is an investigative reporter with our partner, The New York Times, and author of Pay Any Price, Greed, Power, and Endless War. Hoping to get back some good feelings from veterans, the Department of Veterans Affairs is announcing a major overhaul of its healthcare system in advance of Veterans Day. Pink slips for bad apples.
If 1,000 people need to go, give me a sense of what are some of the things that they did.
Well, we're simplistically talking about people who violated our values.
And those values are what?
It's integrity. It's advocacy. It's respect. It's excellence. These are the things that we try to do for our veterans.
New VA Secretary Bob McDonald on CBS's 60 Minutes. As we approach Veterans Day, how do we make up for our past failures to our veterans who've made ultimate sacrifices? And is the VA equipped to take on this challenge? Call us at 877-8-MY-TAKE or find us at facebook.com/thetakeaway. I'm John Hockenberry, broadcasting from the studios of KUOW in Seattle. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by the Henry Luce Foundation for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia, and the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
PRI, Public Radio International.